here is Julie.
My name is Julie. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Julie.
I want to thank Deborah for asking me to speak. This is my home group. The Atlanta group has been my home group since 2008. And I've always done service here. I attend regularly attend meetings here. And I love this group. And it's really important to get a home group. If you don't have one, please get one. Because this is my home group, I celebrated my anniversary here in 2018. In February, I celebrated 17 years of sobriety. And I stand before you, I will not be celebrating next month with 19 years of sobriety. Because 2 years ago, I decided that it would be a good idea to take some pills. And they were really, you know, they were just my mother's pills. And I needed them to help me sleep because my life was really rough back then. And my kids were fighting over inheritance, which was really tough. And my mother was very sick. You know, I was her primary caregiver, and I had a full-time job, and I had sponsees, and I had a program, and I had a lot of responsibilities. I had a really big life. And it just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I say that, this is a cautionary tale. This is a cautionary tale. I hope that you understand that this is my story. And I lost my connection to God. I let my ego come back. I decided to run the show again, just like it says in the big book that you're not supposed to do. You know, I was the actor. I was the director. I just don't you know who I was. I came into this meeting, and a little 12-year-old recently sober woman who I take out for coffee would ask me step questions. And I had sponsees and I had arrived, just like it says in Bill Wilson's story. Except I couldn't really handle some of the unmanageability that was going on in my life. And one of the things that I did in the many years that I was drinking, and I started drinking when I was 12, and I continued drinking. I had a marriage. I burned through it. I fired my ex-husband because he drank more than I did. And he was an alcoholic. And that was in the 90s. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 2001. And I decided, when I found out that I was going to lose those children that were fighting over their father's inheritance, in 2018, they were little kids, and I was about to lose them, and I didn't. And that was when I had my first I have a God in my life moment. It was 2001, 60 days sober, and I realized that this program worked. And I worked this program to the best of my ability as often as I could over the course of 17 years. And I didn't pick up a drink until that day. I didn't pick up a drug. I didn't pick up a drink. I actually never picked up a drink. This relapse is not about alcohol. But I do want to tell you how bad the relapse did get, because it's important that you hear that, that you hear what sitting in these folding chairs in church basements and not telling the truth is very, very painful. And I think that I didn't want you to think less of me. And what happened also over, I guess, in the time that preempted that first Valium in February of 2018, what preempted that, as I said before, was I stopped praying every day. I remember it started because I remember I was you know, when you start to get your bed ready at night and you're folding down sheets and going to brush your teeth, I mean, I remember starting to, like, think, I'm just going to brush my teeth and pray. You know, I'm not going to get on my knees and pray. And I remember looking back now, and looking back now, that was as insidious as this disease starts. That was as insidious as this disease is. Is that I didn't recognize that I was drifting away from God and from you folks. That I didn't realize how easy it was to start lying again. And so little things now in retrospect started happening. Like I started to pray while I'm brushing my teeth. And I started to not pray some mornings because I was too busy. Or I wanted to go to the gym, so I didn't need to go to that meeting. Or I had a date, so I didn't need to go to that meeting. Or I declined a phone call more than many times from Sansi because I didn't feel like it. And I can only explain that for the first year since I've come back, I really did believe it was a loss of connection to God. And it is that. But in addition to that loss of that connection is the ego that comes back. It's that I'm too good for you to see how broken I am again. How dare you think I'm broken again? You have this image of me, and I'm very vain. And that's another character defect. You know, and so when our sponsors ask us to do the work thoroughly, and when the book explains the steps that we're supposed to take, these steps, and how our sponsors guide us through those steps, yet we don't tell our sponsors everything, that's dangerous. And that's what I did. And I beg of you not to do that. If you're sitting here with a secret, it's painful. And it gets worse. So the Valium. led to my mother's dying, right? And that Valium led to, I remember I had a meeting, and I was only taking the Valium. And I'm sober. Nobody knows. Jonathan's one of the many friends who I speak to on a daily basis, many of whom are in here. I didn't tell anybody. And we are as sick as our secrets. And secrets are really, really painful and scary and poisonous. So the Valium led to, I remember sitting down with the hospice worker who came in. And I remember practically drooling as he was telling me the medication he was going to bring into my mother's home. And I took morphine. I took it in handfuls. At that point, I was taking Valium more than two or three. And I took the morphine just like that. And I don't remember anything. You know, that only happened for one day. And I ended up in the hospital. And my son and daughter took me. And they're adults now. And they knew a sober mother. But that's painful. So. And then the next night I repeated a very similar thing where I went back to my mother's apartment and I stole something else. And then my daughter threw me in detox because she's terrified. And then they got me a sober coach, which is the worst thing. Some of the people in this room met Stacy. Okay. She followed me around for a couple of meetings. So my time is up. I don't have my glasses on. So on the last note, I do want to tell you that coming back this year, being honest, being clean in it. Sober, right? But I mean, clean. My soul feels clean. It's what I always wanted. And I think at various times in my sobriety, I may have had this feeling of connection to you, connection to my work and the program, to God. I feel it. It's very, very different for the past 18 months. It's been a very different experience. I do feel more humble. I never really quite got the humility thing. So I'm getting advice on it, and I just want to thank you all because you really all like touched my story.
Sleeping and then just taking big swigs of cognac. I remember just keep on doing it. And in fact, one time when I was, when I got so drunk, my parents were holding me because I kept on vomiting. And I didn't remember almost anything from the rest of the night. And I woke up, when I woke up, it seems like I had some little Invisalign and type of retainer thing. It was filled with vomit. And I thought, oh, that's terrible. That's what I call it, right? Because I thought that, you know, anything that is in my path, anything that's in my way, it's just like, you know, it's whatever. It's not the end of the world. Get over it. And I had this mindset for a while, and it was just, and I kept on just stealing beer from stores. And on stealing beer from stores, it was something that, you know, I was always lying to my parents about. And I tried to run away many times when I was at my house. I wrote a Google Doc to my parents saying, I'm going to go now in Finnish, that's where we're from. I'm going to go now for about a day. Don't worry about me. It's going to be fine. I didn't print it, but I just had my Google Doc. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. This is going to be, you know, what's going to happen. And I remember when I had, when I was sleeping, my parents were saying goodnight to me. I still had a can of beer underneath my bed. And I thought, hey, this is going to be goodnight. And it turns out it wasn't, because I just drank and I just didn't care. And I remember when I started, since I was suspended for about a month, my parents then made me go to a new school. And it was honestly very surprising, because I started, you know, meeting new people, which I hadn't met before, because the school I was in before just really did not fit well for me. And I remember, okay, since I'm going to a new school, I'm going to get friends, I'm going to get good grades, and I'm going to drink harder, and I'm going to do more drugs. Because I was so drunk and drinking, but it was like a whole logical thing that would have happened to me. And pretty much, as soon as I got there, I just, you know, I did start making friends. They started making plans to get high, to get loaded, because that was what I really wanted to do. And pretty much, when I had a break, like, I had another break from school, so I didn't have to do anything. And when I was there, my first plan were, of course, to get loaded. And when I did, my parents, they caught me before I could do anything about it. And then this time, it was serious. So I came out loaded, got drunk, and my parents forced me, you have to go to an AA meeting. And I did not want to. Because I went to an AA meeting, it's losers. I didn't have a problem. You have a problem. I didn't have a problem. I'm better than you. And that's what I thought in my mind. And it was just that I could, since I couldn't really do anything, I decided to go to an AA meeting. And it felt weird. There were too many old people. They kept on asking me, what's your name? And since I thought that, you know, I was above everybody else, so how dare you ask for my name? Are you supposed to know me? And pretty much I just hated it. Just did not like it. And then one of my mom's friends who went to me, who is at the meeting, she told me, hey, just there's good meetings, don't ever have a little drink. It's on Thursday nights. He's in Chelsea. I have a friend who can help you get there. And then I thought, okay, I had absolutely nothing else to do. So I might as well go there. So then I went there. Then I met some other people, and somehow when I went to the meeting and I heard the speaker, I felt I felt a change. I felt a rift in my mind. And I just felt that, like, everything's going to be alright. It was my first real moment with God, or as I come to believe as God. Because before I hate God, I thought God was, you know, the guy in the sky and who calls all the death and destruction in the world. But I knew God was just, it didn't have to be some person, but it had to be something that you had to believe in. because without it, you know, none of us are here. And pretty much as I met my sponsor at that meeting, I heard the first speaker who I actually resonated with. I started working the steps, I finished the steps later in the year, and things started to get better. And I did not know how lucky I am that because of this program, I was able to get better grades. I was able to have amazing friends, and I was able to get sober. I was able to stop this type of thinking in my head, you're worse than everybody. I was like, you're good enough. See, I'll go back to the program. Keep on open days. Thank you all.
Yay!
Our main speaker tonight is Marky.
Community, a very special people here tonight. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. I've got a set of tools to navigate life. You know, I have what I call markers that let me know when I'm off that knee that they talk about. So I have a lot of gratitude. You know, I'm human with flaws, and that's okay today. I don't have to be better than or less than. Anyway, my first drink. it was when I was a child, actually. Somebody was sharing in a meeting, they were talking about the first drink, and of course, thought of me. I was like, you know, the first time I drank was when I was a small child, and my mother used to give me, and it was because what her mother gave her, something called a hot toddy when we were sick. And if you're not familiar with that, it's hot tea, lemon, and honey, and bourbon. And I hated the way it tastes, but I tell you, I loved the way it felt. You know, it was that warmth that permeated to my cells, through my veins. It didn't do the same thing. It wasn't that warm chicken noodle soup you gave me. You know? And I associated right away, I associated being sick with that feeling. And I like to be sick. I didn't like the way it tastes. My favorite dessert was Bananas Foster's, which originated in New Orleans. And what that is it's bananas with rum and sugar, and it forms this syrupy stuff that's poured over ice cream. And it wasn't until years later when I was in sobriety, when I was out at dinner with a bunch of people on the program, I was like, oh my God, they serve Bananas Foster's. It's awesome. That's forever. And they're like, well, you can't have that. And I'm like, okay. It's full of rum. And I was like, oh, okay. And the interesting thing is, I don't like rum. And I don't like ice cream. Yeah, that's what I got out, right? Not weird. Everybody's like, you know, something's wrong with me. I didn't like the way rum balls tasted, but I loved to eat them. Anyway, my first unadulterated drink was when I was 12. And I was at my grandmother's house and with my family, and I was given a glass of wine, and I gulped it down. And when my cousin turned his back, I gulped his down. And then they brought me more wine, and I did the exact same thing. And what I remember is going upstairs where the grown-ups were and going behind their backs and drinking all their cocktails. And I remember those glasses. There were these beautiful green leaves, gold wine. And I remember just going behind, I have non-alcoholic craving right off the bat. And I remember my aunt telling me, Marky, if you keep drinking like that, you're going to be flat on your butt. And I thought, that's exactly what I want. But I don't remember much more. I do remember waking up or coming to, so to speak, in the bathroom and asking God to take me. So at 12 years old, before I ever had a real drink, I'd say, I had this something that needed to be needed some healing that I would be fortunate enough to deal with later in sobriety. The next time I drank, I think I was a teenager, and I was in high school, and always had the phenomenon of craving when I drank, and blacked out just about every time I drank, and kind of came to with all of these shameful things, like these thoughts of or the shameful actions that I did, found out that, like, you know, I did this with somebody's boyfriend, or I come to, like, squatting down carpet, peeing on my friend's floor with the mom waving at me in the doorway. I come to driving the wrong way on the highway. Like, I did all these things. I come to in this bed with someone I didn't know. And so what that showed me much later is that shame and fear won't keep me sober, period. Most of my high school was a LARP. I went to school occasionally. I worked at the King Cabaret on Bourbon Street by night. And I was put in psych hospitals and institutions and all that stuff. Anyway, I ended up getting sent to live with my dad in Michigan. And I was like, I'm going to start over. I'm going to start over. Nobody knows me here. That story, right? And so, anyway, when they go to sleep, I go upstairs and I drink their wine and their whatever was in the cabinet. I didn't care. And one day, my aunt, Nana Mom, was visiting. We were down in the basement. She kept going in her purse and taking out this bottle of something and popping these things in her mouth. I didn't know what it was. And so one day, her purse was upstairs, she was downstairs, she was right ahead of the second lady. So I said, I can probably get up there before she can. And I went up there and opened up this thing. It looked like candy. I didn't know what it was. But I knew it made her calm. So I took it. A lot of since it made amends for that, paid it back. And I took these pills every day, and I drank at night when my dad and his wife were asleep. And I can remember vividly being in the parking lot of this mall. Mind you, my dad had offered me the world, right? This car, I could go to school abroad if I wanted to. He gave me his Saks Fifth Avenue car, these credit cards. And I remember sitting in the parking lot of this mall, and I was never a Pink Floyd fan. I knew of them, I liked them now, but I didn't really know much about them. And that song came on, and there was a line in it that said, I have become comfortably numb. And I remember vividly thinking, I'm numb, but I'm not comfortable. And at some point, that night or a couple nights later, I ended up overdosing on those pills. Fortunately, I was brought to the ER, and as they were pumping my stomach, as they put that tube down my nose and into my stomach, I remember vividly thinking, just like I remember those leaves on those cocktail glasses, I remember vividly thinking and screaming with every cell of my body, put them back. And I really believe that what they were doing to save my life was killing me. The next day, my stepmom picked me up and shipped me back to my mother in Mississippi. And I ended up luckily getting into a treatment facility, and I was there. I ran away. I wasn't the best patient, so to speak. But anyway, I ended up staying sober. And I was living in Poplarville, Mississippi, which that's like in the boonies, Dry County. And I was hanging out with like Sunshine and JB. And we used to get in the car and drive to Picayune, Mississippi for meetings. Let me tell you, when they talk about, a group that would not normally mix, this is the case. And they're much older than me, but they were my family. And they stayed sober for 13 years. And I got really involved in the fellowship of the program. But I never did the steps, And I was happy at times, but I never did the steps. And I didn't hear about the steps anymore, quite frankly. And and you can go to meetings today and you can leave with the disease, right? And I think, one way I can tell people through the litmus test, if you walk out of an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and you didn't hear about the steps or God, chances are you need to go to another meeting. And I think it's so important. But I didn't know. I really didn't, even though they're plastered on the wall. For some reason, they needed me. So, anyway, went to school, became a nurse, had a quote-unquote successful career, moved out to Seattle to do some travel nursing. And I'd say about 12 years into sobriety, I started to think. I started to think, okay, I can relate to that phenomenon of craving when I was young. I can relate to that. I couldn't relate to unmanageability, right? Because I didn't have a checking account. I didn't even have a job, credit card. I didn't have any of that. So I couldn't relate. I find out much later that I had nothing to do with unmanageability, and that's not what it really meant. But I had the phenomenon of, and I also didn't assess over alcohol. So I must not be an alcoholic. I have the allergy I can relate to, but I have to have these other things, and I don't simply have them. So, and plus, that was a phase of adolescence, right? Hospitals, ICU. All those other things. That was just a phase. And I think this is so important because, people often talk about, the first drink that she drunk, and I'm a firm believer that that's not true. That it's my mind that gets me to the first drink that sets off that allergy that's different from the normal drinker that gets me drunk. And so that I need to stay vigilant in this work and, with you guys and my relationship with my higher power. So anyway... So obviously 13 years sober and drink, right? Easy as can be. And I don't remember much of that time that I was drinking. I got engaged, and luckily we got disengaged. But I do know I did a lot of shameful things. I could not get sober again, and I have this idea that I need to be part of this crowd or that crowd at this time. I can have that sobriety too, by the way. But anyway, kind of came to a head. It's a war story I do like to tell. That's a good call, right? War story? I use that term so long. Anyway, where I was working at this place where I really liked the cool this group of women and these doctors. And we're going out, and I wanted to be a part of that. I never counted the drinks I drank before I went out. So I can't even relate that. So anyway, next thing you know, I woke up, I'm waking up, we're coming to the hospital where I worked. And apparently what happened is I had passed out, was unarousable, foaming at the mouth. And they called my mom. There was a neurologist, he checked on people, so they were still reactive. So apparently what happened was, on the way to the hospital, my mom came and picked me up, the car was crashed and totaled. So I was put in an ambulance and brought to the hospital. And she ended up needing surgery, that's how bad the crash was. And that got my attention, right? I mean, I was anesthetized, right? I mean, somebody could have done surgery on me, essentially. And so I came to with so much shame, and thank you, with so much shame, and I ended up having to go home. I'm never going to do that again, get back into AA, and I had to call this woman whose shindig was formed, and apologize, and she said, you know, Marky, I've never seen anyone that drunk. Somebody must have spiked your drink. And I was like, no one spiked your drink. I have a problem, I need to get back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I really meant that at that time. I really did. No one's like my drink. So I put down the drink. I put it down for 2 weeks. That second week I started to think. And I got uncomfortable in my own skin. And I wanted to fix. I had this, tickle I couldn't scratch, I couldn't get to. And I started to think. At the end of those 2 weeks, somebody must have spiked my drink. Such an example of delusional. Right? I'm able to change the story to make it okay for me to drink. So anyway, it was very hard getting sober again, and I kept going in and out. At some point, I thought, maybe I'm one of those people that is constitutionally capable of being honest. And one day I was at work, and I worked in an ICU and carried cell phones around. And so I was on my lunch break, and the charge nurse called me. And she said, Marky, you're getting an admission, 32-year-old overdose on heroin, unresponsive on the ventilator. And I thought, good Lord, lunch. And anyway, so I laughed. I broke, left lunch early. And as I wheeled this young guy in, I didn't know him, but he looked familiar. And it got my attention. And then I went about my business, hooking him up to the monitor. And then his mom came in, she started to weep over the bed. And that got my attention. And then his family members started to come in and weep over his bed. And I started to step back a bit, and look at that. And I got really close to his mother over those 3 days that I was there. I took care of only him. And we got very close, and I talked to him about, did he ever try to get sober? I was really curious. And then I was finished with my shift on the third day, and they were going to withdraw care the next day. And so I went up to his mom, and I gave her a big hug, and I said, you don't know how many people your son has helped. She knew nothing about me. And then I went and I gave him a kiss on the forehead, and I said, thank you. And that was June 8th, 2005. And I'd like to say that, everything got better. I started to do work, and then a big hurricane came through called Katrina, and I ended up in Asheville. I ended up in Asheville, North Carolina. And about 2 years sober, I started going to meetings. I got a sponsor who was popular. I never heard him speak, but she was popular, so I chose her. She asked me why to choose her. What did I say? I never heard him speak. Anyway, about 2 years sober, still not doing the work, uncomfortable in my own skin. I got off the night shift and I pulled up in the driveway. And I had the man in the house, this guy who I had a crush on for 18 years. I mean, since I was 18, he was there. I had the candy and the muffins that I had bought at the grocery store going home that morning because that was going to fix me. And sitting in the car, and nothing's working. And at that moment, I knew alcohol wasn't the solution. I can't count on that, though, right? And I was angry. I had that tickle I couldn't scratch and get to. And so I threw away the junk food, and I was pissed. And I finally reached out to someone who went to meetings and and actually talked about the solution. Here's part of the big book, I can imagine. Can you imagine that? Talked about the program of recovery, and she irritated me. But anyway, I saw that she knew how to get through life, right? And she had a higher power. And even though I went to church and I did all these other things, I was full of fear. And I was comparing myself to all of you. And so I asked her to sponsor me. And I can remember when I asked her, she said, sure, let's meet for some coffee and see if we're a match. I was like, oh my God, a match? Like, I'm not a match for anyone. I'm like, why do I have 2 years just without a drink? I thought, well, after a bottle of wine, you know, we'll loosen up. And I was like, oh no, you can't do that either. But anyway, so we started to meet once a week. And we from the big book. We started the forums. We looked at words. We took the steps very academically. And I had been seeing these steps since, like, 16. You know, I was 16 years old, but I never really knew what they were about. And I was willing to do anything. And looked up words, we talked about what we read, and, you know, we spent a lot of time. We talked about the allergy, easy for me to get to understand. We spent a lot of time on more about alcoholism and talking about the crux of the problem. And, you know, and then we looked at we agnostics. And what was my conception of God? I was told to circle all the words of we agnostic that were capital, that were normally capital words, and I did. And I was okay with the word God, but I loved infinite power and love. You know, and I offer those things. I tell people about that, that they had trouble with the word God initially. But anyway, and so we went over how it works. She pointed out, like, that it says the results are nil. Unless we go, let go, absolutely, and not a little, you know. And anyway, I was just willing to do whatever she said. And yeah, after we read how it worked, we talked about the actor and the director, and I started to understand, I started to see that I was this chameleon, and I would turn into, it was either heavy metal, Metallica, or it was Granola, and I was, you know, Birkenstocks and Dansko. It was like, I didn't know who I was. I thought you wanted for me so that, because I thought that made you to like me to be okay. That was really where it began. And she had me commit that I would pass this on. We got on our knees and did the third step prayer together. And she handed me a notebook and a pen and she said, start doing your list. And so I did. And I just did whatever she said. And at some point during that relationship, time constraints, I ended up taking on another, working with another sponsor who was amazing, and we got into the fourth step, and I really got to see, like, how these dishonest stories in my head, and I still do. I do 10 steps, you know, and I actually got together with my sponsor today before this meeting, and we didn't talk about, oh my God, what am I going to say? I actually read 2 10 steps to her, and that's what I need to do. I need to stay in the solution. And I want to talk about the fear inventory, and that was probably one of the most powerful parts of the four-step for me, is writing down all those fears on paper, and actually seeing them, and seeing where they began, and why I had them, and how my finite self was trying to manage them. And it's really where I developed a relationship with God, right? Because I was able, this program tells me, to develop this relationship of my understanding, you know. And I like to tell this story. I was at a retreat, and this woman tells this story, and she says that her son was in this drawing class, and he was a child, and the teacher gave them this assignment to draw anything they want for a limited amount of time, and the teacher was walking around, and came up upon this young girl and said, what are you drawing, honey? And she said, I'm drawing God. She's like, oh, honey, nobody knows what God looks like. And she said, well, they will in a few minutes. This is about, right? I had to create this God. And as a little girl, I had to fly to Michigan to see my dad. And I can remember, like, being so afraid of the turbulence. And this is a child, and I immediately reached for God. Like, God, you know, please send your angels, hold up the airplane for me. And I imagine that. Or I say, God, you know, please quit feeling so hard, you know. And my God was that strong. My God was that powerful that he could calm the winds, you know, and that's holding me up right now, actually, bigger than this fear right now. Anyway, and that's really where I created this God, and I continue to create this God. And After I did my fifth step, I did 6 and 7. I don't have a lot of time. And then again, my 9 supplements. I followed these directions. She gave me some structure. And then today, I'm at 10, 11, and 12. I always say to the best of my willingness. I hear people say to the best of my ability. And it's really to the best of my willingness. And, you know, it's important for me not to use the tools of this program either to beat myself up. You know, and that's what they told me, that this is just information. You know, I get to see through these steps, like some warning signs, the markers, you know. I think I'm going through some growing pains right now. We just moved to Dallas Ferry, and, you know, when I lived in the city, my markers were public transportation and how I responded to people on the sidewalk, walking the wrong way. Now I see in the car, right? Now it's in the car. Like, why is this person going so slow? I'm missing a lane, you know? And it's like, but I have the ability with God's help to, like, turn that and go, maybe they're being extra cautious, you know? You know, think of it that way. Slow down. Thank you. And then I'm like, oh, I have to constantly watch my thoughts. And I'm like, oh my God, that's so narcissistic, you know, that's so self-centered. And then I was like, oh no, well, God's like, oh no, 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 this is a muscle that needs to be constantly flexed, Marky. You know, it doesn't need a rest day, it needs to become a reflex, you know. So I do that. And as a story, I haven't told Morgan yet, a week ago, well, something last week, I went to where I live, I went to the dentist for the first time at this place, and she said, you know, does anything hurt? And I said, yeah, this toothache right here. And after the assessment, she said, you know, you don't have a cavity, but what it really looks like is that you've been grinding a lot, and that you must clench down a lot. She said, I think you need a thicker retainer. And I was like, thinking to myself, I actually probably need a little more prayer meditation. And I just laughed about it, you know, but it's true this morning. And then, I went back to work and got irritated again. And then I drove home in the evening, and I was parking on the street. I didn't park in the driveway for various reasons. I decided to repark, and I'm like putting on the gas, and the car's like, and I'm like, come on, and I'm like, what's going on? It won't move, and I know that there's nothing, like a ditch or anything, that's stopping me. And I'm like, by God, I'm going to get this car. Everyone comes out of their doors going, what's all that noise? I'm going to get it. And this red light's going off on the dash. And I'm like, oh, the car's already broken. It's brand new. And I just kept doing that. And I was like, you know, look at the red light. And it said, please release the brake. So I'm in that place. Like, I can't see what's directly in front of me. Really. But you know what? And to beat myself up, it's just all warnings, you know, signs. And I'm so grateful for it gives me the opportunity to get closer to God. You know, God's like, yeah, you might need a thicker retainer, but we need a chit-chat a little more. Anyway, you know, so I like to use this program just for that, just for information, not to beat myself up. You know, and I just want to talk about the 12 step and just, you know, being of service and having a purpose. You know, there was a time when I actually did need some more help, and I was talking about that feeling I had when I was 12 years old. And I reached out to someone, and I found, like, things that I didn't remember and I needed to have healed. I was so grateful that I knew that nothing could support this program. Supplant this program or substitute nothing. Nothing could supplant a step, even. And so I had that firm belief. And, you know, I was in a really dark place that I needed help with. And there was times when I didn't want to live, but I will tell you this. When those thoughts came, God came barreling through because of this program. The marker, you have to stay where you are because you have to meet with the sponsee. Like, or you have to speak at this meeting. You know, I had a purpose, which I didn't even know what that was, you know, and that was really important to me. And there was one time, and I told this woman who's my therapist, I told her this story recently. There was a time when I was seeing her, and I was really struggling, and I said to her, I said, you know, I think I'm going to give up my sponsees. And she said, Marky, if you do that, I can't work with you anymore. And I was like, okay. I was pissed, but it worked, you know, because that that was my lifeline, right? She knew that I needed a purpose to stay alive. And I told her that story recently, and she said, yeah, I knew that was a suicidal action. So, got it. So I just want to say, you don't know whose lives you're going to touch. We talk about welcome to the newcomers again. There's people here, I'm sure, that it's over a long time that might be in just as much pain, some people don't stand up and say their day count, so I, what I try to do, and it's hard because I come to meetings and I want to say hi to everybody that I know, is turn to the person that doesn't look familiar. You don't know what kind of effect that'll have on them. It could save their life, We don't need our cell phones out. We don't need to check Facebook. We don't need to do any of that, right? Megan and Harry will be exactly right. I don't understand this whole thing. I've been finished with this story, and you heard it in Vermont. You heard it before. But I love it. I'm still going to share it. So something that was on my four-step resentment was sororities. And my sponsor at that time said to me, "Well, now you're a member of Alpha Alpha."